Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 12, delivered on September 29, 2014. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, Time Value of Money. I want to finish the capital asset pricing model by showing you what the capital asset pricing model is. The CAPM. This will give you the discount rate that is appropriate for use with discounting cash flows for a security, a project, or a portfolio. It's old school, and there are other methods that are now in play, but this is still the one that's popular even out there in the real world. There are, like I said, there are some really fancy new ones out there too now, but essentially, if you want to know the discount rate to use for discounting cash flows back to the present, case of S, the discount rate for a stock is going to be the risk-free rate. Everything gets the risk-free rate, at least, because you wouldn't invest in anything if it didn't at least provide what you could get on a treasury. Plus the beta of the security, which I showed you last time, times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Now, this animal right in here is called the market premium, and it's over risk-free. In other words, what is the reward that you get for investing in the market, expect to get? And I should put up here expected market premium. Market premium over risk-free. In other words, how much more do you get, or should you expect to get, for taking the risk of the market instead of just going with a risk-free treasury? Now, here's where this would be the first class where I will do something that I kind of resisted. Historically, what we used as the proxy for the risk-free rate was a short-term T-bill. In other words, the risk-free rate itself is like a theoretical thing. Remember, that's the real rate of return plus the expected inflation premium. It's a theoretical, but as close as you could get would be a government treasury bill that was very short term because it's effectively risk-free. However, in practice, and I mean I was still holding on and using this very short term, like a three-month, the annual yield on a three-month T-bill until very recently. But what is now being used out in industry is a 10-year treasury notes yield. That's what's being used now. Instead of, and I'm not quite sure why, because a 10-year would carry a little bit of a risk premium, the maturity premium. Remember that treasury does not have risk except for the risk if it's a long-term thing, which is maturity premium. And I'm not sure why this has gotten popular, but this is what's being used now as a 10-year treasury note yield. So just, I was checking on the web. I like to do these in as close to real time as possible. Right now, as of this afternoon, a 10-year T-note is yielding 2.50%. So that would be what we would use for the case of F. is down 4 basis points from yesterday. It was 2.54 at the end of yesterday. Today it's 2.50. It's slid a little bit, which means the price of it is lifted a little bit, which means there's a little bit of buying activity. Now, let me give you a little background. Remember I told you about flight to quality. Investors will move toward risk when it looks like risk is a good idea, but they'll run away if it looks like some economic thing or is turning adverse. In other words, they'll fly to quality. So what we had happen over the last few days, and especially since yesterday, since last weekend, we've been having investors selling out of stocks. So you should see the stock market indices beginning to slide downward. Now, where will they go if they're taking their money out of stocks? They're moving to quality. They'll move toward bonds. So as investors buy bonds, what will happen to the price of bonds? Talk to me. Yeah? They'll go up because the demand is increasing for bonds. So stocks, everyone's running away from stocks, so stock prices will slide, and the money will then be put into bonds, so demand for bonds is going to go up, so bond prices will rise. That's flight to quality. And as a price of a debt instrument rises, its yield should fall. That's that inverse relationship I showed you a couple of weeks ago. Price goes up, yield goes down. It's an unwavering mathematical relationship. So we saw the price of all treasuries, but T-notes especially, went from 2.54 to 2.50. Now, why should that have happened? Why would that not surprise us? If we were in the weekend watching world events, we could have predicted that bond prices would probably rise today and stock prices would be falling today. Why? Anyone know? This is the world out there. This is the world that you have to begin to know. The Hong Kong protests, what are being called the Umbrella Revolution, are getting brutal. They're getting nasty, and that is scaring world markets. Now, why should anyone give a rat's ass about what happens in Hong Kong? Anything? Never mind China. China can kiss my ass. Hong Kong is one of the centers of world banking. And if there are riots in the streets, and we're talking about riots that are now estimated in the hundreds of thousands, and China has this sweet policy of shooting and killing protesters, but now with all the cameras of the world pointed at China and China trying to pretend that it's not the communist nation it is, China's got a problem. It wants to stop this because it's an authoritarian regime that doesn't like protests, and yet you've got hundreds of thousands of people raging through the streets because China's telling them they can't vote for who they want to in the next elections. That's scary to the world's investment community because those banks there, they don't want those, they are afraid if the riots get too bad, there might even be burning bank buildings in Hong Kong. That's scary. That causes a flight to quality across the world. We all start moving out of stocks toward the safety of bonds. Remember, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. We're not at bullets yet, but it wouldn't hurt to stock up at the local store if they got a sale. But anyway, so this is how you start to look at the world. Oh, last week there were protests. These people look pissed. Oh, maybe they'll get bigger. If they get bigger, where is this happening? In Hong Kong, the center of world banking, arguably. And, okay, those are rioters raging through the streets, swirling around all those big bank buildings in Hong Kong. That gets to be a little bit spooky. So we all run to the safety of Uncle Sugar's debt instruments because those will pay off. That's why the price has gone down. About 7%. Just buy it and hold it. And if you ride out the ups and downs over a long period of time, you would have eventually seen an annualized rate of return of maybe about 7%. Now, there's a theoretical, it's in theory. When I say theory here, it's not like just speculation. This is like the theory of gravity or the theory of electromagnetism or the theory of relativity. It's not really theory in a guessing sense. It's just how it works on a theoretical model. There was a complex equation that we could use to forecast the very long-term expected return to the market portfolio. It hinged on a couple of critical parameters. One of them was called Tobin's Q, which was a highly stable parameter of nature, sort of like the speed of light, Avogadro's constant, pi. It was a constant of nature. And that was the driver of the model, of the equation. And the equation said that over a very long period of time, about 7% would be, if you just buy and hold the market portfolio, don't play games shifting and twitching and farting, just hold it. Interestingly enough, in the late 1990s and right around 2000, we had really good evidence that Tobin's Q had shifted. It's sort of like scientists saying, we have just got evidence that the speed of light constant has shifted, or pi has shifted. And it did. And as it is now, the shift has been sufficient so that now the long-term expected hold is not 7%, it's 5%. And it looks like Tobin's Q is not just shifted, it's actually shifted and now it's beginning to slide. So over a longer and longer period of time, the long-term hold yield on the market portfolio will be slipping more, which is great for you because that means you'll be eating cat food in your old age if you invest in the market portfolio. But right now, the consensus actually is above mine. The consensus right now is that the last round that of the service that I participate in, the average was closer to, I think it was like 6.2%. So the consensus is above mine, which means that the consensus is wrong. And we're going to find out. Let's see. We'll find out in just a little bit here. If I'm closer, if you are closer. Are you majoring in finance?
No, marketing.
Marketing? What are you majoring in? Yeah.
Insurance.
It's close. What are you majoring in?
Marketing.
Is there anyone who wants a job when they go? Oh, I'm sorry. We have a few finance majors. Let's see. I'm going to test this 5%. There's a way that I can find out if I'm close, if we're or not. But that's just a little bit down the road here. So let's do something real quick here. Let's get a discount rate for cash flows. And I'm going to use that to start showing you how to calculate the time value of money. But what we're going to do is we're going to get the discount rate for cash flows that Microsoft would create. Okay? Now, so we'll use the 2.5% case of F plus the beta of Microsoft, which is 0.73, times the expected return to the market portfolio, which I am saying is 5%, minus the 2.5%. So notice from this right here that the expected return, the expected market premium, that case of M minus case of F, you should expect to earn an additional 2.5% investing in the market instead of in a treasury note. In other words, 5% minus 2.5% says that you're going to get an additional reward of 2.5% for throwing your money into the market instead of into treasuries. That's what it says. Okay, so let's work that out. If I hammer that out for the cap M, 2.5 plus 0.73, 0.73 times 5 minus 2.5. This is one of the very few places in the whole world where you can actually use the percentages. You don't have to turn them into decimals. Don't do it any place else. But here is okay too. Now I get a 4.33%. So if I want to discount Microsoft future cash flows, divide them by a number to make them present value, I would use about 4.33%. For my dad, yeah. Where's the what, that little thing down below? That's a trading symbol for Microsoft, MSFT. Excuse me. MSFT. MSFT. I will write that a little larger. Okay, here we go. It's a place to start. Okay, now, so one big thing on an exam. If you see a workout problem, and I'm saying things like the expected return of the market portfolio is, the beta of the stock is, the yield on a treasury note is, that is just, you might not know why you're doing it, but you should hit the capital asset pricing model. Just immediately, if I'm saying things like case of F, B, a beta, case of M, just figure out what the CAPM says the discount rate is. That's just gut reaction. And then you'll see pretty much right away why you did that, because I'm probably going to ask you to use that discount rate for some purpose. Okay, so we've got the CAPM has given us a discount rate. So what is that worth to us? And this takes us to the time value of money. Okay, Chuckles, I need you to tell me whether you want $1,000 from me in 10 years or $1,000 from me right now. No, why? Wouldn't you be able to use it in 10 years? Oh, you could use it more now. You could buy food, maybe buy a girlfriend, on Craigslist. For an hour. Okay. Yeah, money now is worth more than money later. So, and actually, if we put money in the bank now, it becomes more later. So this is what we mean by the time value of money. So saying $1,000 in 10 years is the same as $1,000 now, that's not true. As a matter of fact, they're completely different units of measure. It would be like saying that 1 inch is the same as 1 centimeter. We have a conversion formula. Do you remember how to convert an inch into centimeters?
It's 12.
1 inch
is
like... It's 2.54 centimeters. There's a conversion formula. Like liters and gallons, inches, or miles and kilometers and all that kind of stuff. There's a conversion formula. Well, we have conversion formulas for moving money back and forth in time. And they are called the present value and future value formulas. For lump sums, just wads of money, lump sum, the future value of some amount of money, FV is future value, that is its present value times 1 plus your periodic interest rate to the number of periods. That's all it is. Now you got to be a little careful of this, because it's your discount rate. It's whatever you're going to use. For example, let's say that you decide you got $100 from your mom. She gave it to you because you hadn't been home in a long time and she really liked that. So let's say that you could put that in the bank at 6% annual yield, and you're going to put it away for 5 years. Then its future value would be the $100 that your mom gave you with love and kisses times 1 plus 0.06 to the fifth power. Nothing hard about the lump sums. Clear. 1.06 equals, raise it to the fifth, equals times 100. So, in 5 years, it's going to be worth $133.82. In other words, you see this thing right here? This is a conversion formula. Just like centimeters times it by 2.54, that's a conversion. It's like units. It's not like, it is. It converts a present amount to a future amount of money. That's all there is to it. You gotta be a little careful though, because suppose that the compounding of this money was semi-annually. In other words, twice every year. In that case, what I would want to do is I would want to do 100 times 1 plus 0.06 two times a year. So in other words, each period would be only 0.3%, but to the 10th power, 5 times 2. You have to watch if there's some kind of compounding that's not annual. Well, technically, annual is divided by 1 times 1. So remember that always. It's the periodic that matters. And I'm going to show you how to do all this on your calculator, so you don't even have to think about it. You just do it. But in this case, we should see a little. Where the hell did I just put my calculator? Oh, there it is. God. Okay, so in this case, I would do 100 times, open parentheses, 1 plus 0.06 divided by 2, close the parentheses, to the 10th power. Oh, I get a little more money. It comes out, in this case, to be $134.39. A little more. So be sure that you watch for that in anything that I give you. Like I say, compounding, it for semi-annually, that would be 2. What would quarterly be? What would monthly be? I did, 12. I did one on a test a couple of years ago where I did weekly compounding. I had no fewer than a dozen students come up and say, how many weeks are in a year? Mother of God, there are 52. And then this one girl said, well, yeah, what about leap years? And I, anyway, where the hell was I? I started going into that blackout I have when things go wrong. Okay. And by the way, daily, careful. Now they say 365, but there's actually the old school way was to do times years by 365, but divide by 360. That was the way it was always done until now. They all say just do 365. But I've looked at some of the software. I've actually asked some bankers, and they say their computer programs, which are a lot of them are still in the old COBOL language, they still do it with 360 in the denominator and 365 as the multiplier and the exponent. It's just kind of like a historical thing. Why 360 instead of 365? Does anyone know? That was one explanation, was that it encompassed leap years. Another was that it's in banking terms, traditionally there were 5 banking holidays a year. That was the other explanation, was that there were 5 banking holidays a year, so it was 360 instead of 365 for the divisor in the interest rate. The real reason, there was an old trick going back centuries that made it really easy to divide by 360. Now, don't ask me to show you the trick, because the trick is easy once you learn it, but learning it is a pain in the ass. But in the old days, before there were calculators and all that, they would actually, there was this way that you could divide by 360, and it was real fast to do it that way. So dividing interest rates by 360 wasn't a problem mentally to be able to accomplish it. But anyway, now, here's the deal. Why would there be compounding to begin with? Why did this whole compounding trick start? It began back in the 1930s. Because before the 30s, banking was just insane. There was no regulation whatsoever. The Federal Reserve sat on its ass. The Congress and the White House just let the whole financial sector just go insane. And you would get these banks that would promise 50% interest on your money, 100% interest on your money if you deposit with us. Of course, they were pyramid schemes and lies and scams and all that. So when the reform finally happened with the elections in 1932 and all of the rascals were thrown out on their ear, bank reform came about. And I've already mentioned the big bank reform was the Glass-Steagall Act. It just cracked down. I mean, it was like mama comes home and beats the kids. And one part of that was that there was a cap put on interest rates. The cap that was put, no bank could offer on a passbook account more than 5.25% interest. It was illegal to. That was the only way to stop banks from offering these ridiculous, impossible interest rates. So 5.25% was the very top that could be offered. Actually, the banks didn't really sweat, because in reality, the prevailing competitive rate was down around 1-2%, if that. So the banks, they didn't pay attention to it. It was what we call a non-effective price ceiling in economics terms. And no one paid any attention to it. But then as competition heated up in the late 30s, in the 40s, and the 50s, banks began to see that they were having to compete against other investment possibilities that were offering 5.25, 5.3%. Others that were not under this regulation were nudging up above the 5.25, not much at first, but nudging up, and that meant that people were no longer putting money into passbook savings accounts and checking and things like that. They were flowing over here. So the bank, in other words, that 5.25% became an effective price ceiling. It was actually keeping banks from being able to compete in the market for funds that were available from people saving money. So the banks figured out that there wasn't anything in the law against compounding interest, but if you compound interest, it makes the effective yield above the stated yield. Here's the effective yield formula. Effective yield. All you do is take 1 plus the interest rate to the number of periods minus 1. And then, of course, times it by 100%, turn it into a percentage. So, number of compoundings per year, effective yield. So in other words, if there was 1 compounding per year, it'd be 5.25% on that. Now do it semi-annually. In other words, take 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2. 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2, and then raise that to the second power. Minus 1 times 100%. What do you get? Make sure you can do this because this is a quick, dirty question on exam one. I'll just ask, what's the effective yield? You should get 5.32%. Is that what you get? Again, 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2 and raise that quantity to the second power, two compoundings, minus 1. You get 5.32% semiannual. What about 4? Just crank it out. You would do the quantity 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 4, close, raise that to the fourth power, minus 1. 5.35%. Trimonthly compounding. That'd be 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 12 to the 12th power, 5.38%. Daily, using 360, 365, you'd get 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 360, close parentheses, to the 365, minus 1 times 100, 5.47%. You see how, by using compounding, the banks were able to, not radically, but slide around the statutory limit of 5.25%. Because technically, they were still paying 5.25%, but through the compounding process, they were able to nudge the rate above that price ceiling that the government had imposed. That was where compounding got its, basically, well, it had been around before that, but that's where it became popular with banks to offer compoundings of more than once a year, was to nudge the interest rate up. It has a dark side, too, because in a loan, if you're paying, let's say, 7% on a mortgage, because that 7% is annual, but you're paying every month, your effective interest rate is above 7%. So it has its downside too. Well, where are they at? Okay, we got this done. And that's the lump sum thing. Now, turn this around and let's take this formula backwards. I can say that the future value over 1 plus k to the nth power is a present value. So I can find out what money in the future is worth in now dollars. That means that I can tell that $1,000 I offered him in 10 years, I can see what that's worth to him now if I have a discount rate. And by the way, just you'll see me do this. Another way of writing this formula is that the present value is 1 plus k to the negative nth power. A reciprocal is the negative of the power. And sometimes it's easier to do that on your calculator instead of dividing, is just to raise it to the negative power. They're the same thing, and you'll see me write it both ways. But the negative power can sometimes be easier to key in on your calculator. Okay. Your dream is to retire when you are 50 years old with $1 million. Okay? What would you have to put into the bank right now so that... Oh, God, I just made a mistake. I'm not supposed to ask this of a girl. Because now I have to know how old you are. No. Oh, okay. Thank God. You won't be so easy going about that when you're 40, lady. And how old do you think I am? I don't know, you know, like ancient. Anyway, okay, look, so 22 to 50, how many years would that be? 20, you know, 28. Yeah. Okay, so why don't we find out, and let's say that you could put this bank, this money at, let's say, 5%. No, let's be a little more generous. It's that long term. Let's say it's 7%. So in other words, I want a future value of $1 million. And I'm going to discount it at 5%, and let's compound it quarterly. I said 7%. Okay. So I can figure out how much she has to put in the bank now. How much now money will be $1 million in future money 28 years down the line? So what I would do is I would say the present value would be the future value, which is $1 million, divided by 1 plus 0.07 over 4 to the 4 times 28 power. Because it's going to be sitting there for 28 years. Alternately, I can just do this as a single run with negative of 4 times 28. Now, if you're like me, you forget putting parentheses in all the time. So I usually calculate the 4 times 28 before I do anything else. That's just me. That tells you how many compounding periods there will be. So 4 times 28, just to make sure I've got that taken care of, is 112. In other words, this money will compound over 112 times during those 28 years on quarterly compounding. So just cranking it out here, I'm going to take $1 million. I'm going to divide that by 1 plus 0.07 divided by 4 to the 112th power. I want to make sure you get this. If you don't get it, just say, I didn't get it. Really? What'd you get for, what'd you get? What is? Plus 0.07. What was your answer? That's not what I'm getting. Let's try it again here. I got 143,000. Yeah, it's 143. I was going to say 600. That's almost $1 million right there over 28 years. Yeah. You should get 143,266.68. So that's what you would have to put into the bank right now to have that $1 million so you can retire. Now, of course, in 28 years, $1 million will buy you a loaf of bread and some Spam, but that's actually the basis of financial planning, is people tell us, this is what we want at this time in our lives. We want to buy a boat when we're 40. We want to buy a vacation home when we're 50. We want to retire with $10 million when we're 60 or something like that. And so we figure out the present value of that future cash outflow. And we say, okay, this is what you'd have to put in right now. There's another way we can do it too. We can work out payments that will get to that point. But there's the basis right there, a little more than $143,000. If you put it away and left it in an account that paid 7% for 28 years, it would be worth $1 million in 28 years. provided we didn't have the zombie apocalypse or something like that, or protesters burning down the bank buildings. So that's your basis of it. Okay, that's lump sums. They're not all that hard to do. But here's the real trick. Annuities and perpetuities. An annuity is a stream of cash. It's a cash flow. Technically, a lump sum is an annuity of one period. If I were to go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Now, suppose that you got $100 at the end of each year. For 6 years. I could find out what that is called, an annuity. This is a kind of special one because it's called a level annuity. A level annuity. Because it's the same every time. And unfortunately, there's a huge place where these are the annuity. Loan payments are level annuity calculations. But in businesses, you're not going to have level annuity. We would say, for example, you might have a project that might have $100, $300, $800, $2,000, $600, and $100. That'd be more likely what you see in a cash flow profile from a project. It wouldn't be level at all. So if it's not level at all you do to find out how much it's worth here is just take the lump sum present value if it's not level. Or if you want to find the future value, what it's all going to be worth out here, you just take each one individually. But if it's level, there's a good thing that you can do. Now, in this case, when each cash flow component occurs at the end, we call it an ordinary annuity. If it begins at the if every cash flow begins at the beginning, we call it, let me write that up here. We call it an ordinary annuity. If it occurs at the beginning, we call it an annuity due. The only reason you need to identify which it is, and then you can push it into your calculator. So let's get your calculator out. I'm going to show you how wonderful the modern technological age is. And I'm going to do this on a TI-84. On the TI-84, looks like this podcast is going to die here in a couple of minutes. My battery's almost shot, but we're almost to the end here. Once you turn on the calculator, and as I told you in the last lecture, if you look in the top right-hand corner and you see the word no, that means your calculator is upside down. Now, I want you to hit the apps button. And hit finance. And the very first one is the TVM solver. That's the time value of money solver. Go to it. Now, in this case, the N. What's N here? How many of these hits are we going to get? Six of them, right? Six. What's the interest rate? Oh, I didn't give you one. So let's say it's 8%, okay? Now, if you put in 08, I'm going to give you a turbo wedgie. It's 8%. Not without dinner and dancing first, chuckles. Okay, 8%. Just an 8, not a 0.08. Don't be mathematical. Now, do we know the present value? No, we don't. That's what we need to find. So walk over that and go down to the payments. What are each of the payments? Put in $100 in PMT. Now, did I say there was a kicker at the end? If there's a kicker at the end, you would put that kicker, like if you got an extra $200 for being a good boy. There isn't any, so you put a zero there. Now, so there's FV is zero. Now, see that P over Y and C over Y? If you ever change those from one, I will come and bother you in your sleep. And that's not a good thing. Because I have really weird, weird things to show you. Easy does it, boys. Okay, now go down to the end. Are these cash flows appearing at the beginning of every period or at the end of every period? Look at the timeline. What do you say, end or beginning? End. So make watch out for that because, God, I have to calculate the wrong one so that I know if a student did the wrong one, I can give them partial credit because that's the one you don't think to go down there and make sure it's the right way. Okay, now go up here, and I want you to go to the PV. Now, PVs are always come out negative. If you have to put in a present value, you have to put it in negative. That's just the way calculators are. Okay, now I want you to hit alpha solve. What do you get? Negative, it's a negative number, obviously, but that's just the way calculators are. You get $462, right? $462.29. That is the present value of that ordinary level annuity. Okay, that's all there is to it. That's all there is to calculating it. And even to this day, I will sometimes just draw out my timeline just to make sure that I get whether they're beginnings or endings and all of that. You're going to put... $200 away in a 5% account starting now and for the next 20 years. How much will you have at the end of the 20th year? So, in other words, and again, I just draw these out. I'm not even doing this to trifle like you wouldn't know how to do it otherwise. I do it this way just because I want to make sure that I'm not confusing myself. So for 20 years, and then I want to know what it's worth here. So the first thing is, this is a level annuity. So we're good on using these annuity, this little facility on the TI-84. Is this an ordinary or is this an annuity due? Is it occurring at the beginning of every period or at the end of every period? Good. Very good. So the only difference really is just change a few things. N is 20. I percent is, what did I say, 5%? Skip over the present value. Now there's no starting kicker, so there's a zero on the PV. Your payments are 200. There's no kicker at the end, so just go down and go to the beginning because it's a due. There were some people who asked back in the early days of these calculators that could do that. They asked TI if it would please put ordinary and due, and they said, no, we're going to put end and beginning. End and begin, but that's not the financial term, but whatever. Now go up to FV and say alpha solve. Put it on the cursor on the FV and say alpha solve. So what are you going to have in the bank? 66.13.19. Is that right? 20, because there's 20 cash flows. Oh, there are. Oops. I see. 21. You caught me. Shut up. You got me. Yeah, there were 20. Zero plus zero from zero to 20 is 21. Damn it. No wonder I had more residual from that couple I helped plan their money. Okay. I'm going to hell for that one. Look, here's where the great thing is about this. This is how you can calculate your loan payments. You're going to buy your dream car, a Prius. Oh, anyway, it's going to cost you $22,000, and you want 6 years. And your APR is 4.65% on the loan. What are your monthly payments? Just go to your calculator. How many months are in 6 years? Go up to N, and all you have to do, you can do these in there. Go up to N, and just key in 6 times 12. It'll do that. You don't even have to hit the enter button. Just drop down. Just say 6 times 12. You got that? Now your I percent. This is where you have to be careful, because you're going to have to do... Annual is 4.65. So we're going to divide that by 12 to get your monthly interest rate. Remember, it's the periodic interest rate that matters. Now, what's the present value? That's how much you're going to take out the loan for. So key in negative $22,000. Now, the payments are at the end of the month. There's no kicker anywhere. So you can just stop, make sure you're on the end, okay? Now, put your cursor over PMT and hit alpha solve. What are your monthly payments? What is it? $350.75. You can calculate your loan payments. Again, at the top, 6 times 12. Interest rate is 4.65 divided by 12. Your present value is negative $22,000. That's what is now going to be. And then you go down to your payment, because future value is zero. Everything else is fine. And you'll get $350.75. Now you can calculate auto payments and home payments. And we'll do some more of these the next time. But as I promised at the beginning, there is one more thing that's Just a quick little formula. Perpetuities. A perpetuity is the same amount every time for the rest of eternity. Now, if you had a perpetuity, the present value of an infinite cash flow that goes forever, which we assume corporate dividends do because corporations can't die, theoretically. So we're actually figuring out if a stock did not, the dividend did not change from year to year to year to year, the present value of the perpetuity would be the dividend divided by your discount rate. That's all it is. That would be the present value of an infinite stream of the very same amount of money at the same time every year forever. Now, we have one little variation on that. If the dividend grows at a constant rate, the formula would be the present value is the dividend one period out, in other words, 1 plus G, over the discount rate minus G. So what does that mean for a price of a stock? If we were to say Microsoft is essentially the price of its stock, it's a present value of an infinite stream of dividends growing at a constant rate forever, what would the price of Microsoft be? Well, the dividend on Microsoft is $1.24. Let's say that the growth rate is 2% per year. And on the denominator, I figured that Microsoft's discount rate is 4.33%. Whoops. 0.0433 minus 0.02. If we thought that Microsoft, its price is nothing but the present value of a claim on an infinite stream of dividends. Its dividend right now is $1.24, so for the constant growth, we have to grow at one period. And then in the denominator, you divide by the discount rate minus the growth rate. Do that calculation for me, real quick. Humor me. $1.24 times 1.02 divided by 0.0433 minus 0.02 So tell me, could you pull up anyone on a laptop what the price of Microsoft is? My calculation comes out with $54.28. What's the price of Microsoft right now? Anyone got it? Oh, not bad. Price of Microsoft right now, the market says, is $46.44. So in other words, my calculation says it's a buy at 46. That's the basis of arbitrage. I calculated, market calculates, and if I'm right, well, there you go. Anyway, that's all I have for you. I thank you.